From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Indira Lakshmanan of the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, and this is On Point. A sleek red sports car is on its way past the red planet, hurtling beyond Mars and towards the asteroid belt. Silicon Valley tech visionary Elon Musk's automotive and aeronautical passions came together Tuesday as he launched one of his luxury Tesla Roadsters into space, high atop SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket. It's a big moment for the commercial spaceflight industry, where the possibilities for innovation seem endless. This hour on Point, SpaceX and the future of the private space industry. You can join us on air or online. Was Tuesday's achievement one small step or one giant leap for commercial spaceflight? Do you remember the heyday of NASA's space program, maybe even the missions to the moon? And with all the successes of the private industry, do you worry that NASA is being left in the dust? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And here's that moment from Tuesday afternoon, the SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket taking off at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida, from the same launch pad used for the Apollo missions in the 1960s and 70s, and later for the space shuttle.
Five, four, three, two, one. Ignition.
Joining me now from New York is Miriam Kramer. She's deputy science editor for Mashable, where she covers space. She was at that launch of the SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket in Cape Canaveral, Florida. Miriam Kramer, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're delighted you could join us. So you were actually there on the ground when the action happened and the big heavy rocket blasted off and all the smoke clouds came around. So what was it like? Tell us.
It was pretty incredible. I have to say, I've seen quite a few rocket launches in my time as a space reporter, and this one kind of blows the others out of the water. Just the roar of it, it's such a huge rocket. It shook the ground. You kind of like feel it in your chest. And then just watching it, it was a really slow moving rocket. So just watching it slowly move up through clouds and then out past where you could see it, it was pretty incredible, actually.
Watching the images, though, I was thinking, with all those, you know, the tremendous force and noise and all those clouds, how far away did you have to be to safely watch it?
So I think I was about 3 miles away, which is puts you kind of at the NASA press site. So even from that distance, it was still just, it shook you.
Wow.
Yeah, you have to be pretty far from these things just in case.
All right. Well, I mean, given the size and the power of this rocket that you're describing, is it maybe the closest thing to seeing an Apollo mission launch for those of us who didn't live through the 50s and the 60s space race?
I think so. The Saturn V rocket is larger. It was larger than the Falcon Heavy. So I'd imagine that roar was even greater. But I think that this is about as close as we come these days to seeing something that extreme kind of going off to space.
And tell us a little bit about how the people around you were reacting.
Oh, my God. It was amazing. Everybody was kind of in awe of it, I would say. And these are, you know, these are people who have covered spaceflight for a very long time. But everyone was excited. We all kind of ran outside from the press room where we were all writing and trying to file our stories ahead of time. And we all ran outside and you just could hear gasps around you. People like saying, oh, my God, it was clear that everybody was very excited to be there and happy to see this thing actually launch.
There is something about space that I think takes us all back to our childhoods and sort of makes us kids again, the sort of sheer excitement and delight and the imagination and kind of, you know, this boundless possibility of going into space. But, you know, all right, take us through the chronology of Falcon Heavy's leading up to Tuesday's launch. How long did it take SpaceX to get to this point?
Yeah, so this, I think that this is one of the more compelling parts of the Falcon Heavy story. Basically, I think Elon Musk announced in, I believe, 2011, that they had the intention to build the Falcon Heavy, and they were hoping to launch it by 2012 or 2013. And from there, it just got mired in technical delays. It became a much more difficult program to work on than anybody had expected. They thought that it was going to be as easy as strapping three of their Falcon 9 rockets together and basically just allowing it to launch. But that did not turn out to be the case. Apparently, SpaceX attempted to cancel the program three separate times, but they kept going. And basically, that led to this 2018 launch, which was, you know, 5 or 6 years in the making, really.
Well, you mentioned Elon Musk, who's, of course, the visionary founder both of Tesla and of SpaceX. Let's listen to him shortly after the launch of Falcon Heavy, calling the mission a success.
We're really excited about today. Incredibly proud of the SpaceX team. They've done an incredible job of creating, well, really the most advanced rocket in the world and the biggest rocket in the world. The mission seems to have gone really as well as one could have hoped, with the exception of the Santa Core. That was the two side boosters. If you guys are here, you saw them land. That was epic. I think that's probably the most exciting thing I've ever seen, literally, ever.
All right. So what were his real goals here in the launch, and why was he able to declare it a success?
So I think that the main goal was to get it off the pad without it exploding. If you heard Elon speaking before the launch, he thought that there was about a 50-50 shot that it was actually going to work. So that was sort of the first big hurdle that they got over. It lifted off, which is great. And they also managed to land two of the three boosters that they were attempting to land back on Earth. So that's another milestone that they hit and did quite well, aside from losing the main core.
All right. So two of the three boosters were landed back. And what's significant about that is this notion of reuse and recycle. So it's not just more space junk. Is that the idea?
Yeah, exactly. And it also lowers the cost of launching to space. I mean, launching to space is incredibly expensive. So if they can actually bring back these boosters, which historically has not been done before, really, then and land them back on Earth, that means that they can refurbish them and then reuse them for additional flights to space, basically meaning that you only have to pay for the cost of fuel.
Well, that, of course, was another exciting moment. And let's listen. This is the moment when Falcon Heavy's two side boosters landed just over 8 minutes after liftoff.
Side boosters' landing legs have deployed.
So that is literally people screaming and cheering. I mean, it sounds like it was almost as much excitement as the liftoff itself, just to see these two boosters landing back very gently, almost like, you know, vertical airplanes.
Yeah, I would say it's even more exciting. And even just being on the ground, I couldn't see the full landing happen in front of me because we were just too far away. But you could see sort of the relight of these two boosters, these twin boosters, as they were coming back in. So you suddenly, like in the clear blue sky, you see these two flames and you know that those are the boosters coming back to land at the Cape. And it was just, it was like science fiction. It was just, it was watching the future, basically.
All right. Tell us, though, about the sports car. I think everybody was kind of like, that was mind-bending, too. This red sports car that most people in their lifetimes could never hope to earn the money to afford. And Elon Musk has strapped it onto a rocket and sent it into literally deep space with this mannequin test dummy they named Starman.
Yeah, it's quite a bit of corporate synergy for them with Tesla and SpaceX. But yeah, it's you know, Elon just launched his Tesla Roadster off into space as basically ballast. I mean, it was a weight that would allow them to launch something. And he always said he wanted to do something fun for this first launch of the Falcon Heavy. And I would say he accomplished that goal.
All right. Well, that's all very exciting. But what about SpaceX's past failures? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. So SpaceX has had some pretty notable failures, particularly when it comes to the Falcon 9 program. They had a couple of failures, one on the pad and one in the air in the last couple years. But that said, they've bounced back really well. And last year, they had kind of this banner year of dozens of launches, breaking their own records and landing multiple boosters back on Earth. And it just seemed flawless. It just seemed very smooth. smooth and easy.
Well, I mean, the failures, to be clear, were as recent as September of last year when a SpaceX rocket exploded during a pre-launch test. And there was a $200 million communications satellite that was destroyed. Elon Musk even, admitted that it was the most difficult and complex failure ever in the company's history. And they went on this four-month launch hiatus. So I'm wondering, does this now suddenly redeem SpaceX in the eyes of the public?
I'm not sure about that. It's interesting because I think that Falcon Heavy was a test flight. So had it failed, it wouldn't have grounded their Falcon 9 program necessarily, because it's just an entirely different rocket. So the Falcon 9 is kind of SpaceX's bread and butter. And when that one, when a Falcon 9 fails, that's when they really get into trouble. So yeah, that September accident, I believe in 2016
that's
was...
That's right. Thank you.
No, of course. It was that was a big problem for them. Standing down for 4 months, I'm sure SpaceX doesn't release their numbers, but I'm sure it cut into their margins and their bottom line. It must have been a very expensive failure for them. But that said, coming back from it, they really sort of redeemed themselves in 2017 and kind of had a very good year. We'll see kind of what happens next, though.
All right. Well, a lot of our listeners are already getting in on the conversation. Ben Carbonetti says on Twitter, I admire Musk's admiration and the launch was amazing, but it still makes me sad that NASA has to rely on private actors so much now. Depending on rich people to do things we as a society should all be invested in makes it harder for me to get excited. We're talking about the future of private commercial space exploration after the successful launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket on Tuesday. And this, of course, is David Bowie's Starman from the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. It's a little tribute we're giving to the mannequin named Starman behind the wheel of that Tesla. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is On Point. There's a star.
This episode of On Point is supported by 23andMe. This Valentine's Day, give someone special a DNA kit from 23andMe. They can receive over 75 detailed online reports about their genetic ancestry, inherited traits, and even information about their health. Go to 23andme.com/onpoint to get 20% off each kit, now through February 14th. Offer includes free gift wrap.
You have access to the entire world of NPR with your smart speaker. Ask it to play NPR or your local NPR station to check the news while you get ready for work or fix dinner. There's a new radio in your house, and it's easier than ever to listen to Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and more. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local NPR station.
This is On Point. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and that, of course, is 2001 Space Odyssey. We're talking this hour about private commercial spaceflight after SpaceX successfully launched its big Falcon Heavy rocket on Tuesday. You can join our conversation. Should private companies take the lead on space exploration and innovation? Or is the last frontier best left to the U.S. government and NASA as it has been for the past 60 years? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I've been talking with Miriam Kramer, deputy science editor for Mashable, who covers space. And joining us now from Boulder, Colorado, is Phil Larson. He's an assistant dean at the University of Colorado's College of Engineering and Applied Science. He used to work for SpaceX, and he's also a former space advisor in the Obama administration. Phil Larson, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Indira.
Hi. So I want to ask you, first of all, what was your reaction to Falcon Heavy's launch? You know, what went through your head as a recent SpaceX employee?
Sure. And as a space geek since elementary school, I can tell you it was a visceral reaction to something that I think a lot of us have been excited for a long time. So my heart was with the team in Florida and in California as it, you know, came off the launch pad and was successful.
So tell me, technologically, how groundbreaking is what we saw on Tuesday?
It was a pretty big deal. A lot of firsts happened. First of all, being, you know, the heaviest, the most powerful operational rocket in the world taking off, and 27 engines. You know, the Falcon 9, as Miriam called it, their bread and butter, has 9 engines. But getting 27 to launch and light all at the same time was a feat in and of itself, and a lot of people had questions about that. And then bringing those two boosters back simultaneously, Elon talked about, you know, offsetting a little bit so the radar might not interact as much. That was also a first-time thing. So a lot of firsts, but maybe first and foremost was it was a private company that did it. Taxpayer dollars weren't on the line if this launch, you know, went south. So it was, you know, a pretty big deal.
So I want to ask you, what is possible and realistic in the future of spaceflight versus what is completely pie in the sky, you know, no pun intended, never going to happen? I'm thinking of your old boss, Elon Musk, in 2015, telling the public radio show Marketplace about his vision for humanity reaching beyond the confines of Earth.
The smart move here is to take advantage of this opportunity and make life multiplanetary. And you'll note I said multiplanetary. It's not like some escape from Earth or something like that.
All right, multiplanetary? What is Elon Musk talking about, and is that even something we should be conceiving of?
Oh, for sure. And it's you know, with these private sector attacking these goals, it really opens up the aperture for what we can accomplish in terms of exploration. And it doesn't necessarily need to be all on the taxpayer's dime, but I think there is a strategic imperative, a strategic importance for exploration beyond low Earth orbit that the government does have a stake in. In many ways, it proves our, you know, clout as a technological powerhouse. So it makes sense for companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, ULA, Boeing and Lockheed to partner with NASA to push the bounds of exploration, to become a multiplanetary species, to go back to the moon and explore asteroids. It's definitely feasible, and the way we do it will be in this kind of public-private partnership method.
Well, so what's the time frame that Elon Musk is thinking of when he talks about multiplanetary? Does he mean that there are going to be humans living on the moon or on Mars in 50 years, 100 years, or what?
Well, if you talk to Elon, I think it would be a lot sooner than 50 or 100 years. He does sometimes get a little – his timetable's a little bit off, but he does end up accomplishing what he sets out to do. And that's kind of the excitement of the innovation that the private sector brings. So I think it's definitely feasible within the next 10 or 20 years to be, you know, fulfilling some of the goals him, NASA, and others are laying out for exploration.
You know, you talk about the innovation that the private sector brings, but let's not forget that this is in a lot of ways like the early days of aviation. You think of 747s rolling off the assembly line, but that whole industry was seeded with government investment. And that's what we're seeing now. People like SpaceX, people like Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin, I mean, they are benefiting from all the government investment that went in through NASA, right?
That is absolutely right, and I would say we are all benefiting. I think it behooves the taxpayer and NASA and the government to take advantage of these companies and what they're doing. You know, they're lowering the cost of access to space. They're tackling things like reusability. And they are standing on the shoulders of, you know, the Apollo program, the space shuttle program, and the space station. But that's, you know, to extend our reach into space, we have to extend our economic sphere. That's, you know, part of the way that we'll be able to explore these places is because we're not just, you know, at the whims of political elections, at the whims of political budgeting as we come up on another budget crisis. So like, you know, de-shackling it from government while strategically investing, I think is the way to go.
All right. Well, let's bring in some of our listeners. There are a lot of people very excited to get into the conversation. And Larry is calling us from Buffalo, New York. Larry, go ahead. Welcome.
Hi, Indira.
Hi.
I was calling to talk about one of the aspects of the private enterprise taking over the space is that I have the concern that the science discoveries and the information that is gained through these would be shared with the broader public to benefit everyone. In the NASA program, when they discovered or made advances in technology through the exploration of space, because it was public funding, the results were also made public. I'm curious as to how there's going to be that guarantee of sharing of information and benefits from the commercial companies to those who are interested in the space odyssey.
All right. Thank you, Larry. All right. So let me put that question to you, Phil. How much will SpaceX and these other private companies share their findings with NASA, with the U.S. government? Is it a true public-private partnership that is really going to benefit the American people, or is it just going to benefit these companies?
It already is benefiting the American people. And in these partnerships, you know, NASA is getting cargo and soon crew to the space station for, you know, dramatically lower cost than the different, you know, the previous way of doing business. And in terms of the public-private partnership, if you're doing science missions, if you're launching Earth science spacecraft, Mars rovers, missions to Europa and Jupiter, Pluto even, that will be funded. That will be the public part of the public-private partnership. That will be funded by NASA, and that will ensure that the science, the imagery, all of the groundbreaking discoveries that are made are part of the American ethos and part of, that are owned by the American people. So, you know, think of it like the car companies and the Jeep companies that make vehicles for the Department of Defense don't supplant the mission of the Pentagon. They just enable it. And that's what this is doing. It's enabling a whole new class of missions that will benefit us all.
All right. Well, I want to bring in someone who works today in the world of private commercial space applications. Christian Mender is the director of in-space manufacturing and research at Axiom Space in Houston, Texas. Christian Mender, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Indira.
Hi. So you are working on a pretty ambitious goal at Axiom. Tell us what it is.
Sure. So Axiom was formed with the intention to build the world's first commercial space station to support what we see as a growing demand from both companies and nations that are seeking sustained human access to low Earth orbit for both commercial and government needs. Our main vision at Axiom is to make living and working in space as commonplace as possible.
All right. So how far along are you on your timeline of building this commercial international space station, and how much is it going to cost?
Well, we're fairly early in the process. From a design perspective, we've got our requirements identified, and we've started with some design concepts that we're working to vet with NASA to know that they can work. Our intention is to use the International Space Station today to host a couple components of our space station before we jump off and become a free flyer. Our goal is to get some of our first components into space by about 2021. And from a cost perspective, those numbers aren't necessarily public, but our intention is to bring the cost of building such a space station several orders of magnitude down from what it took to build something as technologically advanced and huge as the International Space Station.
All right. So where do you see the commercial space industry going 10 to 20 years from now? Where is it going to be? Is it going to be NASA sort of hitching a ride? Right now, they're hitching rides with the Russians to go out to the International Space Station. Is it going to be hitching rides with private companies to go out to your space station?
Similarly, yes, I think so. The thing, and I'll play off what Phil has said already, as NASA moves the tip of the spear forward on exploration and takes us deeper into the solar system, NASA and its partners who are going to be doing that exploration really need companies like ours to build the framework for helping move that exploration beyond low Earth orbit. But you need infrastructure in low Earth orbit to support all of those endeavors. And companies like ours will establish commercial services in low Earth orbit to support that as it moves forward. We see that there's 10 years down the road, as we see the work that's being done on space station today, both in the research arena and both in the in-space manufacturing arena, things that you can only make in space, there's a growing demand for access to low Earth orbit from commercial entities that will come and follow and be additional customers beyond the government.
Well, I'm curious how collaborative or competitive you are with governments. I mean, what is your relationship with NASA, or for that matter, with the Russian or the Chinese space programs?
Well, our relationship with NASA today, we have a Space Act agreement that enables both parties to work closely to do all the feasibility assessments necessary to talk about how we can put parts of our commercial space station up on International Space Station. And that relationship will grow as NASA creates opportunities for companies like ours to use the space station resources to go and build out this space station. From a relationship to other governments, we're in the business of flying a number of different customers, including astronauts from both established and emerging space nations, tourists seeking to experience the ultimate destination, and then, of course, what I've spoken already with commercial and government customers who intend to use the platform to test technologies needed to send humans further into the solar system and do the research and use it as the unique environment of space to manufacture goods. We welcome any nation that would want to do business in space.
All right. Thank you so much. Kristen Mender is Director of In-Space Manufacturing and Research at Axiom Space in Houston, Texas. Kristen, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go to another one of our callers. Bill is calling us from Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Indira. Thanks for having me.
Yes, absolutely.
Ten years ago, from 2001 to 2009, I was a subcontractor and a partner through Space Act Agreement with NASA on ISS and the Constellation program. We built systems engineering and integration tools as well as simulations out of JSC. And I just want to push back a little bit on this idea that SpaceX has benefited tremendously from government. The contract that SpaceX has with NASA is performance-based, and Elon Musk has laid it on the line over and over and over again, put his entire personal fortune and everything, his entire reputation and personal fortune, on the line for SpaceX. And he's just my hero. He's just my hero. And I just want to make sure everybody understands just how difficult it is to fly rockets into space.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. I really appreciate your call. Phil Larson, you know, you've worked not only at SpaceX with Elon Musk, but with NASA from the White House, and now you're a professor. So, you know, you're in a really unique position to talk to us about how these two sectors can cooperate and coexist. And what comes to my mind is, you know, 500 years ago in the age of exploration, Ferdinand and Isabella funded Columbus's voyage to the New World. But after that, wasn't it, you know, the Dutch and East India companies that were actually funding people to go to the New World because there was profit to be had? Is that the same model?
That's a great analogy. The government should be on the leading edge of research, development, technology, exploration, investing in the basic technologies needed to push the envelope on what we can do in space. But we also want the private sector to follow behind, come with the capitalistic model. That's how we'll do more in space. That's how we'll also innovate and lower the cost of getting to space. So as NASA focuses on the basic technologies, the robotic probes to the farthest reaches of the universe, you know, then the private sector can fill in behind. It's the same model you mentioned before as the aviation industry. It was born out of, you know, government research and development contracts, military airplanes first, and then leading to a postal, you know, postal delivery and contracts. And that led to the first TWAs and the Pan Ams, which was initially was just for the well-off, you know, citizens. But eventually it got to economies of scale, and we all benefit from it. And that's, I think, the same model. You could say the same thing with the internet. You know, ARPA and DARPA created the internet in the 60s and 70s. And in the late 80s and 90s, it was unleashed to the private sector, and we saw $1 trillion in economic growth. That's what we're trying to create, I think, in the space exploration realm.
All right. So just very briefly, what about the taxpayer role in Tuesday's launch? Did we, the American public, pay in any way for that project?
I would say in terms of that specific launch, it was all, as you know, Elon talked about, $500 million of SpaceX money going into the development of Falcon Heavy. It was all SpaceX and private sector dollars. But leading up to that point, you know, Falcon Heavy is three Falcon 9s strapped together. That was partially developed, you know, hand in glove with the government, because NASA would benefit from having that service, having that delivery service to low Earth orbit. And so there's a study that the Falcon 9 and Dragon spacecraft that SpaceX operates cost up to one-tenth the price of NASA doing it a traditional way.
Interesting.
So
all right.
We did have some skin in the game.
We only have a few seconds left, but you worked for Obama, who was criticized for not devoting enough to space. How's Trump doing?
Well, we focused on these partnerships in the Obama administration, and it's potentially great to see the Trump administration focusing on doubling down on them. But the devil's in the details. We haven't seen the budgets. We've just kind of seen the lip service. So it'll be interesting to see comes out in the budget.
We'll keep watching. Phil Larson, Assistant Dean at the University of Colorado, thank you so much for your time today. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is On Point.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punderful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. And that, of course, is Bill Conti's iconic theme music from the 1983 film The Right Stuff, about Project Mercury and the dawn of the manned space program. We're talking this hour about the future of commercial space exploration and research after SpaceX successfully launched its Falcon Heavy rocket on Tuesday. You can join our conversation. Do you see a modern-day space race between companies, like what we saw between the U.S. and Russia in the 1950s and 60s? Does NASA need to get back in the game, or is it a waste of taxpayer money? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio or online, onpointradio.org. Some of you are already having your say. Brian Jones says to us on Facebook, nothing says excesses of capitalism, greed is good, and unrestrained ego like blasting a sports car into space. Cars don't drive in space, and poverty exists here. David Craze says, is NASA even needed anymore? Privatization is working better. But Podman says, do not underestimate the importance of these launches on our children, who can be inspired by something other than military conquest and destruction to a better, more civilized use of technology, a brighter and more hopeful path for future adventure. I've been speaking with Miriam Kramer. She's deputy science editor at Mashable. She covers space and was at Tuesday's Falcon Heavy launch at Cape Canaveral. And I want to bring into our conversation now Henry Hertzfeld. He's professor of space policy and international affairs at George Washington University in the nation's capital. He's an expert on economic and legal issues in space and also the commercial use of space technologies. He has advised Planetary Resources, which is a company developing and deploying technologies for asteroid mining. I mean, that really sounds far out. Henry Hertzfeld, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Indira.
All right. I want us to listen to Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, who launched his own space venture known as Blue Origin, talking about what his company wants to accomplish.
The long-term goal of Blue Origin is to not only do suborbital, but also orbital, and to democratize space travel so that anybody who wants to go into space can afford to do so.
So, Henry, Jeff Bezos's vision sounds a bit different than what we've been talking about so far, which was exploration and research. Is this really about space tourism?
Tourism is probably an overstatement. Adventurism, yes. Space is still risky, and it's still quite an adventure. But there have been, for a number of years, people who have expressed the desire to go to space, and this, there is a market out there. How big it is we can question, but there are people who are willing to pay to go to space just to see it. And that's, I think, only part of Blue Origin's plan. They're building a big rocket, and I think they will try to compete with SpaceX and with the existing ULA rockets, the Atlas and the Delta, and perhaps even some foreign launch companies. Hmm. So, but with all launches, you have to have something to do in space.
That's right.
And so just building a launch vehicle is not enough in and of itself.
Well, you know, it's funny. On Monday, Jeff Bezos, who's, of course, this huge Silicon Valley personality, wished SpaceX good luck in the next day's launch on Twitter, to which Elon Musk, the head of SpaceX and Tesla, replied thanks with a kiss emoji. So, Miriam Kramer, tell us, I mean, is it possible for Blue Origin and SpaceX to coexist?
I think so. I think that at the moment, especially, I mean, Blue Origin is attempting to do something very different than what SpaceX is doing right now. Blue Origin's ambitions are to eventually probably compete with SpaceX for those big, heavy launches. But at the moment, they are focusing on sort of space tourism, basically, for lack of a better word, as Henry said, to bring people up into space for a minute and then kind of bring them back down, let them see the Earth against the blackness of space and kind of experience what space flight is like. So certainly at the moment, they are able to happily coexist together. The future may hold something different, though.
All right. Let's bring in one of our callers. Cheryl is calling us from Concord, North Carolina. Cheryl, welcome.
Hi, Indira.
Hi.
The comment that I would make is, ever since I heard about this sports car being launched into orbit, it's ridiculous. And if a person, as long as they have enough money, they can do anything they want. I think this is a very good example of just pure hubris. That we are so in tune with making money that just any ridiculous thing will go. And it worries me to think that there's a man that has so much money that he can put more space junk into space, although it's not in the orbit of our planet. I understand that, but this is just, it's so ridiculous I can't even comment any further.
Well, thank you for that comment, Cheryl. And that's, I think, a very useful voice to have in the conversation. You know, a lot of people were excited about Tuesday's launch, but a lot of people were probably sitting there thinking, what a waste of money, what a waste of energy, and is this all about ego? So, Henry, you work on the economics of all of this. Is she right? Does Cheryl have a point?
Yes, but you have to keep in mind, first of all, you know, it's tremendous credit to SpaceX and Elon Musk for the technology that he's developed. Nobody can question that, and he's a showman. But keep in mind that this was a test flight. He's trying to prove that he has reliability and he can launch and continue to launch this type of rocket safely over time. And that's what we have to do. We have to sit back and we have to let them try to prove that this, like some other rockets, has the potential to be a reliable vehicle into the future. Then we will see whether other companies will buy the launches from him. And one of the biggest customers is not a company, but it's also the government. There is a demand for exploration. There is a demand to put scientific instruments and other things in space. And many of these investments by all of the companies that are vying to go to space depend upon the government right now, not only for seed money, but as an anchor tenant for many of the things they want to do. In the longer run, they hope to sell things commercially. That's the opportunity to make a profit from commercial sales. It hasn't really been demonstrated yet.
All right. Let's bring in another one of our callers, Richard from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Welcome, Richard.
Hi, Indira.
Hi.
The last caller
I respect her thought about the quote-unquote waste of money, but space exploration and space creativity is about creating hope for a society, exploration and creative acts. I mean, the creativity of NASA and the current companies is astronomical. That gives the American people a creative expression, an artistic expression. Putting the car on top of this rocket, it was a beautiful artistic expression.
All right. And thank you so much, Richard. Really appreciate it. All right, Miriam, you know, how do you take what Richard says, that this is also about the creativity of the human soul and, you know, the future of what we can do, things that we can't even imagine now that we might be able to do? So tell us a little bit about how you see the future of space research, space exploration. I mean, Henry has worked on asteroid mining, for goodness sake. What could this possibly take us to? Could it help us with climate change? Could it help us in other ways we haven't yet thought of?
Yeah, I mean, I want to believe that the future of space exploration is bright. I mean, there are so many great ideas out there, from sort of asteroid mining to these private space stations that Christian was talking about earlier. And generally, I believe that we're moving towards something. What that is, I'm not totally sure. If that's, you know, people living on Mars or a moon base, or even some way of, you know, flying things interplanetary, or I mean interstellar. The future is kind of wide open at this point. The question is also whether we decide to fund it, and part of that is the excitement of people, just normal taxpayers, people in the U.S., people around the world who want to see these things happen. And it can't be overstated enough that, you know, slowly NASA's budget has declined, in part because interest in space has declined. And I think that if we want to see these amazing things, it's kind of up to the people. It's whether, you know, we demand that funding or not.
All right. Well, Henry, I want to ask you, since you work on the economic and the legal concerns of space, President Trump has said that he'll do better, that many administrations before him have rolled back funding to space. He's going to do it better, he says. Does that mean letting private companies launch from the Kennedy Space Center? Or, you know, in what way is he going to make it better? Is he going to just privatize space?
I think there will be efforts to have more partnerships with companies and with other governments in the things we do. We'll probably put a little bit more in. NASA's budget's actually been quite level over the last few years, and even a slightly larger. Not large enough to do all of the things that NASA would like to do, but their budget's about $20 billion a year. And generally well spent. There are people they're building a big launch vehicle as well, and it is very expensive. But they're building it to different requirements, different specifications. And the question is really whether these private launches like the Falcon Heavy and others can do the same things. And also NASA's an agency that believes in and exists on the human presence in space, and they're trying to build another launch vehicle that's human rated, and with all the risk aversion efforts, you want to make sure that it's safe. That's what costs a lot of money. I know Elon wants to do the same thing, and hopefully he can do it safely and meet some of those requirements as well, but We're committed to space. This administration, I know, is, and I know they're going to seek partnerships to try to get this done.
So some of our listeners are getting in on the act here. Politics Watcher says to us on our website, I'll confess to being unexpectedly moved by the live feed of the whimsical Tesla sports car floating through space, our planet in the background. A shiny example of human technical achievement and of human sense of humor. A project about lifting us up, not pushing other people down. All right, let's bring in one of our callers. Tina is on the line from Bay St. Louis, Missouri. Tina. Or Mississippi, hi. I'm sorry. Is it Mississippi?
Down on the Gulf Coast.
All right.
Hi, Indira.
Welcome.
I'm a NASA contracting officer, and I don't really have a question, just a quick comment. I know you're always short on time, but you made a comment, is NASA being left in the dust? And also, does NASA need to get back in the game? I just believe that NASA had a planned strategic exit from building the space shuttle. And it was planned over time. It was very strategic, and we let commercial companies come in. And you can see what is the result of that just from this recent launch. So I believe there will always be a partnership between NASA and private industry from now on. And, yes, we do hitch a ride with the Russians now. That may change in the future based on where this technology goes. But NASA has focused its resources in R&D space technology. And this is what allows this to happen commercially. So the companies put in their bids for research dollars, they win, and then these types of developments happen. So NASA's in the game just from a different aspect this time. Well, and I just wanted to make those comments, and I'll take your comments off the air.
Tina, thank you so much. It's great to get a voice from NASA into the conversation. Really appreciate that. So, Miriam, I'm sure you interview people from NASA all the time in your reporting. Is what Tina said, you know, pretty much the prevailing view?
I'm not sure about prevailing. I mean, NASA is a large organization, but I do think that that's along the lines of what a lot of people feel. And it's absolutely true. I mean, NASA got out of the space shuttle program. That was very much the goal. And commercial crew was set to replace it, was expected to replace it, but it just hasn't come along quite as quickly as initially expected, hence why we are hitching rides on Russian rockets. But to hear SpaceX and Boeing tell it that they will start launching crew for NASA within the next couple years. So we'll kind of see where that goes.
All right. Thank you. One of our listeners, Jeff from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, says he thinks the launch was awesome, but what keeps anyone from copying this technology for nefarious purposes? So, Henry, let me go to you. Is there a Dr. Evil out there who could copy this for nefarious purposes? Or are there laws in place that prevent that?
Well, there are intellectual property laws, of course, and there are patents and other types of protections. But this is difficult. I mean, other nations have built large launch vehicles, but nothing like this. This is the largest in the world. And it does illustrate that the United States has the inherent technologies. One more point I want to bring out, and that is, since the very beginning, and even the Apollo era, NASA spent 80% of its money with private companies. We're doing it differently. They're trying to buy services now rather than put out the specifications and have companies build to government specs.
All right. Thank you. That's Henry Hertzfeld, professor of space policy at George Washington University. Thank you so much for joining me. Also on the line, Miriam Kramer, deputy science editor for Mashable. So great to have you with us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Coming up tomorrow, the weekly news roundtable. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, and this is On Point.